Many of us have been surprised by an unexpectedly high cloud bill to the extent that it's sort of become a joke in the industry at this point. But of course, running a network, running a cloud environment is indeed serious business, and we have to be mindful of cloud costs, where there's inefficiencies, possibly misconfigurations, or maybe poor architectural decisions that led to these unnecessary costs. Well, with me today are Carl Fugate and TJ Carden, both experienced, seasoned cloud engineers with plenty of experience and knowledge and insight into cloud cost optimization, a topic that's become just as important as learning cloud technology itself. And today we'll be talking about what drives cloud costs, specifically on the network side, and what steps we can take to optimize our cloud network environment. My name is Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Carl and TJ, thanks so much for joining today. And it's great to meet you for the first time, TJ. And then Carl, it's great to see you again. We got to see each other recently at the Kansas City NUG just last month. So that was really cool. So thanks so much for joining. Before we dive into today's episode, we need some introductions here because TJ, I'm just starting to get you to know you for the first time. So why don't you give us a little background about yourself, personal if you like, but professional, how you came into this cloud networking business and what you're doing these days.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. So my story is actually kind of interesting. I started in the world of networking when I was in high school, wanted to play Doom with my friends and my family, and that meant setting up a network. My dad was a network engineer and system admin, but just didn't have the time. So he brought home cables and terminators and the whole nine yards, and I literally was pulling cable through vents just so I could play Doom and throw LAN parties. So that's where I started, ended up getting into software engineering out of college, and then running some OpenStack clusters that required massive automation to get some big data stuff going while I was at Lockheed Martin. And that's what really got me into the DevOps world, which led to the cloud world, and then spent the last decade or so very much as an AWS cloud guy. Mm-hmm. Networking has definitely fallen into my background, so this won't be my forte, but nowadays I actually run a consultancy that's really focused on cloud cost engineering. Mm-hmm. And so from a cost perspective and kind of where do we look for savings and how do we engineer for savings, that's very much right there in my sweet spot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how so many different personas in technology have sort of converged in the cloud world. You know, there are folks that have never had to think about networking that are sort of having to think about networking when they're managing their workload in the cloud. And then then folks on the network side that never had to think about other things, you know, they're all of a sudden cloud engineers. It's interesting stuff. And Carl, it's good to see you again. How about a little bit of your background for our audience?
Yeah, thanks, Phil. You know, kind of like TJ, the network gaming was definitely what caught my interest into networking way back in college. That led me to work for a telecommunications service provider doing mobile wireless for almost a decade before I moved in kind of more into the network consulting in various spaces. Most recently, I've made the pivot into cloud and cloud architecture. Mm-hmm. For a healthcare software company. So working to deliver SaaS solutions to clients. So definitely having the networking background has been incredibly valuable. As one of my former mentors said, networking is the cause of and the solution to all problems.
Oh, nice.
And that's all true no matter where you're hosting your workloads.
So do you work predominantly with AWS or multiple different cloud providers?
Yeah, so definitely predominantly AWS, but okay. I'm definitely working a lot more in Azure these days as well, a little bit of GCP, so, and obviously still some private clouds, so
right.
Kind of all the clouds.
All the clouds. So TJ mentioned Doom. What was the video game that you were interested in that kind of got you into the space, into technology?
Yeah.
Don't say Leisure Suit Larry.
No. So we were doing some Mac gaming back in the day. This is way back, but Marathon was the kind of the first person shooter for on the Mac platform. That or a game called Bolo, which was like a 2D tank strategy game. It was more Mac gaming for me back then. Mm, that's just our that's what our school had.
That's what the school had. Okay, fair enough. Yeah. For me, I remember very vividly playing Wolfenstein 3D and being just blown away at that whole concept of exploring an entire level. And the whole first-person shooter, too, was neat. But just that open concept of exploring a level was so cool instead of like a side-scroller. Really neat. I really enjoyed that. So let's get into today's topic. I did just receive an AWS bill personally for, I think, $12.14. So I'm not really hard up for cash in the sense that 12 bucks was like a hit to my portfolio. I'm still going to be able, I'm on track to retire, sort of, kind of. It depends if you ask my wife or not. But that's not the case for a lot of organizations today that are, you know, sort of re-strategizing how they approach cloud, how they approach where they put workloads and how those workloads communicate with each other, perhaps among different clouds, perhaps between their cloud resources and back on premises, whatever, all that kind of stuff. So I'd like to start by asking this question, just kind of putting it out there. What are the main drivers of cloud costs? So when I get, I assume that we're going to be sticking a lot with AWS today, and that's completely fine since they have the vast majority of the market share. What are the main drivers behind that bill that an organization is going to get periodically?
Sure, I'll take a shot. So it's all over the map. It really just depends on what your workloads are. But I think the key when it comes to cloud cost is you're charged by the drink. And so it's a very different mindset than a lot of finance people and a lot of traditional engineers are used to. It's one of the greatest strengths of the cloud. I can have access to a massive amount of compute for an afternoon and then turn it off and not be paying for it anymore. But it also can lead to really, really big surprises. So you mentioned your $12 bill. But, you know, one silly afternoon that you spin something up you didn't realize that sits there for 3 or 4 days and, you know, suddenly you're getting a multi-$1,000 bill. And the corporate equivalent of that is, you know, you've got to really understand the architecture of what you're bringing to the cloud. Because if you don't, you can get really, really surprised by where those costs do show up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of that, you know, looking at how networking inside of cloud is consumed, right? You know, the pay by the drink is really pay by the byte. And if you ask any networking team, you know, that's operating in a private cloud today, like how much data are you moving around? They really can't tell you. They could give you speeds and feeds. But they have no idea how much an application in particular is actually transferring and which ones are communicating with what. And when you get into public cloud, that becomes a really important, thing that you need to understand, because how you actually lay out and design things is going to be directly influenced by that. And if not done properly, you can definitely end up in a situation where you're paying significantly more to enable communications between things than you would expect.
Okay, so there is a strong case for traffic engineering for cloud engineers who may not have been network engineers, and all of a sudden kind of sort of are, at least in a cloud context. And I know that a lot of the constructs, the networking constructs in AWS and other clouds, I mean, fundamentally, they are very similar, if not the same, as traditional networking, but perhaps with a different name or perhaps with another level of abstraction. So I can't tweak it quite as much, or I have to do it in a different way. But ultimately, there is still that element of traffic engineering in order to manipulate where traffic is going. And I'm going to assume also understand where it's going, both in volume and in its format and type. Because that is going to be a main driver of that AWS bill that I get. how much traffic, what kind of traffic, where is it going? Obviously, there's caveats there. I know there's like formulas. I've been on the AWS website looking at that, and there's, you know, formulas there, and trying to figure that out can be a little bit difficult, at least for me. But basing it on, you know, the difference between intercloud, intracloud, traffic leaving the cloud and going down to my branch office or my on-prem data center, and that egress traffic, all components driving that overall cost bill. But I mean, this kind of assumes that we know how the traffic is flowing in our network, where those hotspots are that are incurring significant cost and therefore are possibly inefficient or due to a misconfiguration or a bad architectural design, whatever the reason. But we're going to have to understand both in the planning and in the testing and then in the ongoing day two support what the traffic looks like. So how do we actually do this in practice? What are we doing to determine where the problems are and how to fix them?
Yeah, I think, you know, just to kind of start out, and you kind of mentioned abstractions, and I think this is a really important thing for people to do is not get lost in the abstraction. So fundamentally, you know, the saying that, you know, the cloud is just somebody else's computer, or in this case, just somebody else's network is really important. Fundamentally, when we're looking at, you know, consuming networking resources inside of the cloud, we really just need to kind of think back to, hey, how would I have designed this, you know, within my own data center if I were architecting for connecting these solutions together. And fundamentally understanding, hey, where am I going to be at a point where I'm consuming really expensive resources, right? So if I can keep things local, you know, to a particular switch or within a particular spine, that traffic is essentially free, right? It's a sunk cost, and there's really no additional cost, you know, for me to go from one thing to another. But if all of a sudden I want to go from one data center to another data center, now I'm going to have to go over much more expensive WAN links. And that's really those same concepts apply within the public cloud providers, you know, and those could be, you know, called availability zones or something else. And so you start to look at, hey, where are those finite resource constraints? Because that's where those charges are going to start to pop up, is where those additional resources are that the cloud provider needs to have to be able to enable that service connectivity. So if I have to buy really expensive WAN links because I'm going between, you know, two different locations, you can be assured that those are the pieces where they're going to charge for that service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can expect the costs to scale in a similar fashion. So, you know, this has been a topic that's been a little bit hot in the news, not so much really recently, but about 12 months ago, because there's definitely different approaches from the different vendors as well. So traditionally, bringing data into the cloud was free. We want your data. But getting data back out, they're going to charge you for. And so it makes things like hybrid cloud, potentially, if you're a data heavy company, much more expensive. Because every time that data is transiting, you're paying somebody. And it's even reached the point where it's becoming almost a marketing tool for some of the smaller players. So Oracle, for example, has much lower networking fees than the bigger players do. And they're using that as a way to try to pull, and especially for them, data heavy customers away from some of the bigger players. They're saying, hey, look, we're best at data anyway. Our egress charges are better. We're the best player in town, and we play nice. And they, you know, then try to paint everybody else as the bad guy who's just trying to lock you in with these fees. So you have some of that. And then, you know, kind of the different types of fees, as Carl said. So speaking specifically AWS terminology, but they're all very similar. They have what they call availability zones, which are generally speaking single data center, but depending on the region, maybe two or three different buildings, but they're physically within thousands of feet of one another. So you're running, you know, fiber optic lines between those, very, very fast, very low latency. And as long as I'm within that availability zone, traffic is free. within what they call a region, which could be a single physical location with a couple different buildings, or it could be like US East that's probably at least a dozen separate locations within, you know, dozens of miles of each other. So still very close, but now you're going over significantly more expensive connections. And so they charge you there, and it's not super transparent. They tell you it's a penny per gig, but it's actually a penny per gig on the way out and a penny per gig on the way in. So it's really 2 pennies per gig, right? And then if I want to leave the region, that's a different charge. And if I want to leave AWS as a whole, that's a different charge. And that's just your data. That's before we start talking about all the different abstractions and all the different resources that you can use for, you know, VPNs and direct connects and, you know, other ways to really do global type networking within the cloud ecosystem.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I do understand that the network piece of a cloud bill, an AWS bill, is proportionately smaller than all of the other components that are going to drive the overall cost that an organization sees month to month much more than the network piece. But we can control the network piece in that we can make these decisions, albeit there's trade-offs there, but we can make these decisions about whether we're using a direct connect or we're using a VPN over the public WAN. And also, as Carl alluded to, the way we architect our overall solution and the decisions that we make about where we put resources and where those egress points are going to be, what kind of egress points we use. And so I guess that's my next question is, it's not really a question, but I'd like to discuss the trade-offs now. Just as an example, I mean, is it always better to go with a direct connect just because of the quality of the connection? Is it always better to go with a VPN over public WAN if you're cost conscious, maybe a little bit of both?
Yeah, I mean, so connectivity is really important. And, you know, to that point, there is no one size fits all. So I've worked, you know, with just about every possible way to connect to public cloud providers, from, you know, just, you know, direct, you know, public WAN internet connectivity, to VPN, to MPLS and direct connections. And all of them have their pros and cons, to them. And, you know, I would say that, just looking at, you know, the last two, you know, projects that I've done with public cloud providers, almost always you end up with some hybrid approach. It's not even just one. We will have certain things where it makes absolute sense. And because of reliability, because of latency characteristics, we would absolutely do, you know, some sort of direct connect, where I'm going to have a dedicated private WAN connection, you know, right onto the cloud, you know, on ramp backbone. But in other cases, I need to make sure that this service is available to lots of people, with high bandwidth, and maybe I don't know exactly where things are going to come from, you know, the public WAN can be, you know, a good solution for that if I don't need those kind of guaranteed SLAs. So that's one of the beauties of cloud, and it wasn't like this originally, right? Cloud has evolved to kind of service a lot of different needs. It started with internet only, but now you can connect in a lot of different ways depending on your use case.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And to your point, the options are there. And that's an exciting place to be, where you can make those trade-off decisions. For me, I think a lot of it when I'm working with clients is helping them recognize total cost of ownership. So, you know, I worked at a company where when we first started networking with AWS, we were pretty small. We didn't have a lot of budget. We were looking at direct connects, and it was going to be, you know, like $1,200 a month. And at the time, that was substantial for us. And so we stood up a VPN that was like $45 a month, right, and did the job just fine. Well, fast forward some time later, and, you know, we've continued to grow that pattern across multiple VPCs, across multiple accounts. And we've reached a point where I think we had 82 VPNs and like 75 what Amazon calls VPC peering connections, which is,
right,
sort of an internal concept, and the total cost was still super manageable. But when you actually think TCO and you look at the cognitive load that puts on your networking team and the downtime when something breaks and you're trying to troubleshoot which of these 75 VPN connections is causing problems, it very quickly became a very, very expensive. And so we moved from that towards an MPLS solution that we already had to connect our sites. And we said, hey, how do we just connect all of our cloud networks into that MPLS as well? So we just have one beautiful giant network. And our networking team was not doing a lot of cloud. All our cloud networking was our cloud team. And so it put the corporate network back into the hands of the network experts. They had to learn a little bit more about the cloud, but it got them responsible for the overall schematic of our network, and they were able to dramatically simplify it and significantly reduce that total cost, even though the AWS bill may have actually gone up a little bit.
Right.
But the amount of labor we were spending keeping the network happy and healthy was much, much, much lower. So that's something that, especially when you're working across finance and executive team and engineers and network engineers and software, like you got all these players that all view things very myopically. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm trying to work those situations, we really have to get everybody thinking in that total cost of ownership perspective to be able to start really seeing through that complexity and say, what makes the most sense here?
Yeah. And that's what you mean by cognitive cost, right? The total cost of ownership in terms of the management of this entire web of connections and systems and all of that. Yeah. I don't know what you mean by myopic, though. I thought we broke down all the silos and technology a long time ago and that we were all one big happy family now. Am I wrong?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Right.
Well, that's what the software engineers tell me. They say, just give me keys to AWS and now I can build my own network and my own infrastructure and my own code, and there's no more silos. We won't talk about what happens when they do that, but
it works really well right up until they all deploy, each of them deploys VPCs with, 10/16, and then they say, hey, I need these to communicate with each other.
Doesn't happen, Carl.
Never happens. No, but those are definitely really important concepts. And TJ kind of nailed it, right? So when looking at cloud, it's not all about the bill. A lot of times, especially depending on where a company is in their kind of cloud native journey, you have to start to look at where do I want to have expertise? What are my core competencies, as a business? And, having a, super strong, networking team, that can troubleshoot the most complicated, cloud design known to man may not be the most, the greatest use of resources. Maybe I'm going to go ahead and pay more for some of these network abstractions that a lot of the cloud providers, have. And so even though that cost is more, if it allows my developers to move faster because they're not having to, work with the networking team to build some complicated design, that value is probably worth it in the long run.
Now, in terms of analyzing and understanding this overall architecture, this cloud environment, and then the nature of the traffic that's traversing over transit gateways and NAT gateways and leaving one availability zone and going from one region to another region or whatever it happens to be, those things that incur costs. And so in this this exercise of understanding architecture, understanding where our resources live, but then really digging into where the traffic is really going, what tools do you two use to do that? And this is not a leading question where you have to answer with Kentik. I want to know if maybe you're predominantly using those cloud native tools that the providers give you, or are you using third-party tools or maybe some combination of the two?
I'll say the vendor tools have improved dramatically in the last few years. They used to really not be very helpful. and they're making big strides, but I think we're still at a place where the partner ecosystem gives you a lot more visibility into some of those items. And even is a little tangential, but a lot of the network level resources, when you think about like firewalls, you know, especially if you're a really high security company where you want to be doing traffic analysis and things like that, I think the vendors have come a really long way, but they're still just not even close to what you can accomplish when you bring in a partner. So that's probably the big thing. I'd also say it's a little challenging because you don't have as much control. You're kind of limited to what gets exposed. And because of the security model of a big shared world, things like packet sniffing, for example, become much more complicated than they are in your home network. But you know, Carl, I know you guys, I'm sure, have a lot of this going on over at your place. What are you doing?
Yeah, no, and I would agree. So, you know, we try to use first party tools, you know, whenever possible. And, you know, we've got a saying that, you know, the cloud tools are about 74%. They get you about three quarters of the way there, you know, from a feature and functionality perspective. And for a lot of people, that's all you need. But certainly, you know, we've seen that, you know, that doesn't get us far enough in a lot of areas. And we've definitely had to go out and bring in third party tools to do some of these things, bring in, you know, additional features. So we've done some demos and brought in some of our previous partners, into the cloud ecosystem. You know, there's, you know, I will name drop one. So I think ExtraHop has been, you know, something that we've used a lot on-prem to be able to understand network traffic, and that solution works really well within the AWS ecosystem, at least. But again, the first party tools now are getting so much better to a point where there's a lot less need to go outside of it. You know, one of the other things is we really hadn't talked about kind of network function virtualization, but, you know, these replacing kind of the first party network services with third party services, whether those are firewalls, routers, load balancers, et cetera. So bringing those things in, you know, the great thing is, all of the tooling and things that I already have, or the management platforms that I have for those tools, can give you a lot of visibility into your network traffic as well.
Okay, so walk me through how you would approach, or at least how you would think about analyzing your cloud environment with this idea of cost optimization, of analyzing maybe the architecture, and then of course analyzing network traffic, focusing on the network side, to reduce a cloud bill, or perhaps to weigh those trade-offs between cost and performance and all that sort of thing.
I would say so for me, the very first thing is make sure you're reading the pricing guides. You know, the very first step for me when looking at a public cloud service is to go look at the cost guide. How are you going to charge for the service? Really helps me understand how am I going to go design for it. And I'll give you a really good example of this. So one of the things, and again, you know, I think TJ kind of mentioned it earlier, the pricing model for a lot of network services is changing over time. A lot of things are starting to become table stakes. Things like egress fees are starting to, you know, the providers are starting to do away with some of them. But one of the changes that AWS made, you know, last year or just the year before was around how they handled traffic between availability zones. So within an availability zone, you know, if you're staying within your VPC, that traffic was free. There's no cost for that. So one of the things that we needed to do was deploy a backup solution because we needed something that could work in a very particular way. And so we needed a multi-availability zone backup solution. Well, the problem is, if I'm deploying this and I have, you know, my EC2 instances in one availability zone, but they're backing up to an EC2 and yet another availability zone, I was paying for all of that traffic. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, you know, even though they could be in the same VPC, I was still paying for this traffic. Now, one of the things that I could do is say, hey, how can I make sure and align those traffic flows? And so in our particular case, we were actually able to deploy instances within each availability zone. And so, and now no matter which VPC it is, I can actually map my instances from one of it, from backing up to that same availability zone.
Right. Okay.
And so by aligning that traffic, now I don't have to pay these cross availability zone fees. And so really it's digging in and just kind of understanding, hey, where am I going to get charged? And then understanding, hey, how can I go back and look at the actual workflows? And I wouldn't do everything, right? In this particular case, backups are a huge volume driver, right? So I know that's going to be a significant amount of volume and thus cost. Am I going to worry about something that, you know, transfers 100 megabytes a month? I'm not going to worry about those things.
Right. Yeah, of course.
So really just focusing on your heavy hitters, those big traffic data sinks, that's where the value is.
Yeah. And some of this depends whether you're talking in a greenfield or a brownfield environment. Okay. So, you know, one of the first things I'll do with a client is we'll just look at their bill. We'll just say, like, what sticks out? And for me, you know, networking rarely does, partly because the networking costs are very reasonable as long as you're not doing really unusual things. But we'll look at just what is the thing that looks weird, and then we'll dig in and we'll say, well, why is it happening? I just read an article a couple weeks ago about a company that was using Kafka, which is like a message broker service. And one of the really central concepts of Kafka is that it's highly resilient. And so when you write a message, it then spreads that message out to multiple nodes. And inherently, the whole point there is, well, I want nodes in each availability zone so that if an availability zone goes down, my cluster is still happy and healthy. But every message I write then scatters across zones. And then every time I read, Kafka tells me, oh, you don't actually want to read from me. You want to go read from over there. And so what they found was they were spending almost four times as much on network transit as they were on storage for this Kafka cluster. And it's just because it was engineered for an on-prem world back when we did all our big data stuff on-prem. And so it doesn't fit the model well. And so understanding that leads to a couple things. One, there's actually a new project out that uses the whole Kafka API, but behind the scenes, it's using S3 for storage and for communication. Because, and this is an important part of a more greenfield view, is as I'm designing, there are certain services that don't have transit fees. They're considered regional services. So S3, mm-hmm. DynamoDB, there's a couple others where all the cross zone stuff is happening on the back plane and behind the scenes, and you don't get billed for it. And so they've actually built an implementation now of Kafka that all of the crosstalking is happening in S3. So there's no transit fees. And, you know, there's performance implications and other things there, but it's going into it and understanding, like, how is this going to impact my model when we're deploying something new with companies I work with? Like, we actually build our own cost model in Excel of what do we think this thing's going to look like And then we start tweaking and saying, well, what if this, you know, does that change what service we're going to use because of the way that they're priced? To Carl's point, like, you have to go understand the pricing model of each service.
Yeah. And you bring one thing that there, and it's again, everything that, you know, there's always some gotcha, you know, when you go to look at these things. And so, you know, one of the things TJ just mentioned is about communicating with like these global or these regional service, you know, services like S3 or others. Well, in order to, make that so that you're not paying for that cost, you actually have to deploy a service endpoint into your VPC, and then you get that. But if you don't, if you forget, which we have, and now it's part of our infrastructure as code model when we deploy VPCs to make sure that we're deploying these endpoints, we were actually getting charged where people were going and hitting an S3 API, but they were going out to the internet in order to hit that instead of using, you know, that direct connection right within the AWS VPC to go do that. And that cost, you know, a significantly.
So, and now instead of free, you get the most expensive kind of
email. Yes, exactly.
So you're tromboning out and then back into AWS without realizing it.
I'm going out AWS to come back into AWS.
In an effort to...
You probably never actually leave their hardware.
But I went through the toll booth.
Right.
Yep.
So I see on the outline something that I don't know how to interpret this. I see one of the points says here, the hidden costs of NAT gateways and idle regions. I know what an idle region is. I get that part. But you got to help me a little bit, maybe educate me on the hidden costs of NAT gateway. I know what a NAT gateway is, but what does this mean that there are hidden costs there?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different strategies for how to manage kind of your AWS account structure. And the most common modern approach is to have lots of accounts. So Team X gets their own AWS account where we can isolate all the things they're doing. And there's a lot of benefits from security to cost allocation. But what often happens, especially in orgs that are like mostly mature, but not quite mature yet, is you start to get this template of, well, an account gets 3 availability zones, and each availability zone gets a public subnet, and each public subnet gets a NAT gateway, and then you get some private subnets. And so what you end up is like, you just build this template infrastructure. And I specifically bring up the NAT gateways. They're not bad. They're 50, 60 bucks a month, something like that. Like, they're not expensive, but if my template's not built right, and every account gets 3 regions with 3 availability zones that each have an NAT gateway, you know, suddenly my baseline cost for an account that's doing absolutely nothing is $700-$900 a month. And so like, you're not bleeding depending on how big an organization you are, but it's just complete and total waste. Nobody's even looking at US West. They're just doing a quick little POC on US East. And, you know, they're pumping 100 megabytes a month through this NAT gateway, but I'm paying for it, versus a more holistic strategy where we say, actually, all of our internet transit's going to go through our networking account through a single cluster of NAT gateways that we may even add, you know, a number of our own tools to, in which case we're deploying a third-party NAT instead of an AWS NAT. And now all these little vended accounts that we build have to transit back through there instead. And all of that little onesie twosie, you know, death by a million cut cost folds back towards this really powerful appliance that actually has a bunch of benefits from a security and manageability perspective and is actually less expensive than what I would have ended up with otherwise.
I was just having this conversation yesterday. So like we've been pondering, you know, the benefits of a centralized NAT gateway, you know, deployment for quite some time. And, you know, this also is coming into a discussion around, you know, first party versus third party network appliances. So, you know, we've, We've used, third party, firewalls within, public cloud to get, certain levels of visibility that the first party native, tools just don't provide. And, but recently, those platforms are starting to become, have more feature parity, to the third party tools. And one of the benefits with the AWS firewall service is you do not have to pay for NAT gateway. So if you deploy this in kind of a centralized manner, you no longer need NAT gateways because it's provided as part of that service. But going back to one of the earlier things, that is not it's free as in I don't have to pay for NAT gateways, but it's not free when we look at the network complexity. Right now, I have to do things like either stand up VPC peerings or stand up a transit gateway, and I have to route all of this traffic back, and I have to have all of these routing policies to be able to get traffic from one place to another. And so that operational complexity increases as well. And that might be a great thing if you're looking at a greenfield network deployment, but if you're in a brownfield and deployment, going back and ripping out NAT gateways and updating all of your routes,
sure.
That's like doing open heart surgery, on the network.
Right. Yep. Yeah. We don't wiggle wires during the day either. So it's definitely a project.
See, I've never heard that, that analogy before, but that's a perfect analogy for pretty much any network change. I come from a DevOps world where you do everything in the development environment and then the test environment. Mm-hmm. And when I started talking to our network engineers about like, how do you do cloud right? It quickly became apparent that, well, there's not a development environment for the network. So, I mean, you got to keep the data flowing while you're making changes. And that's kind of terrifying.
Yeah, I've spent many an evening and a night, middle of the night, sweating and in a cold sweat, I should say, while I'm doing some sort of cutover or some sort of upgrade. What we're doing there is we're messing with the substrate, the mechanism of application delivery, which is what everybody cares about. Nobody cares about the network, but they care about this thing they're logging into. And like I said, if you wiggle the wrong wire, Chicago goes offline, and all you did was bump into an SFP. You didn't do anything either. So it's just so networking folks, I believe, and I was one of them, very risk averse for that reason. Our test environment is production. So now we've danced around some of these ideas of strategizing around cost. We've talked about understanding traffic flows, some tools that you've brought up. Carl, you talked about just being more mindful of how you architect your solution. TJ, you mentioned the total cost, not total cost of ownership. What was the phrase that you used? Total cost of cloud, TCC. Let's go with that. What are some specific strategies that folks can walk away from this episode from to really understand how they can either minimize their cost, if that's a goal, or to understand it better so they can do some of those things that you said where they make those decisions and trade-offs in their own design?
Yeah, I would say the very first thing is if you have a cloud networking team and they're not looking, if your FinOps people are not looking at the bill with them, you're missing out. In a lot of organizations, somebody else gets the bill and it just gets paid, and as long as it was within budget, all's well, and we just move on. But I know TJ has pointed out some really good examples of this, and this is actually how we found some of ours, is where we're looking at cost and it's just going up and up and up every month. And then that's how we realize, hey, something's not right here. And we need to go actually dig into why is this cost getting, so high? And, that's what led us to find those opportunities to go back and actually optimize, some of our deployments. So start by looking at your bills. And if you're just because you're a network engineer doesn't mean that you don't need to understand kind of how the bill is structured in each month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Carl used a term, you know, FinOps, that's maybe not familiar to a lot of people yet. It's mm-hmm. rapidly growing, but the notion behind FinOps is really, how do we bring finance and engineering together to understand the cloud? Because, you know, as Carl said, like, look at your bill. It's remarkable, because of that pay per drink model, how quickly it's too late. Just a matter of days, and you can rack up months worth of spending. So, you know, my biggest thing would be, one, set up anomaly detection, whether that's through a third party app or through the first party tools. Most have options now to, like, as soon as things look weird, it's going to notify somebody, and you can start digging in. And then the second, from a planning perspective, is just recognize how much you don't know, because we are still siloed. I think cloud has really changed the way that a lot of engineering happens. And it certainly led to kind of software developers broadening their skill set. But especially, I would say, the networking side of things has still lagged way, way, way behind, to where most people that are building cloud assets really don't understand networks at all. And in a lot of cases, they're not getting a networking expert involved. And so kind of getting that seat at the table, if you're in the networking world, but you're not really in the cloud world, you know, I mentioned my last company, our network engineers dealt with on-prem and our cloud team dealt with the cloud. Like, we got to talk more, and then we got to get that engineering team in as we're planning that new thing, and get those different perspectives during, like, an architecture review process, so that the questions are being asked. Because engineers generally aren't going to be asking, oh, you know, how much network transit am I going to see in this? They need that perspective coming in and saying, hey guys, you know, there's a lot of cost with this. Like, how is the way you're designing your app going to impact my network? And when you ask the question, they can speak to it. It's just, it's not something that's on their mind. And then likewise, when you have networking projects that you're planning, right, you want to be having those conversations that involve the finance team, that involve the engineering team, and saying, like, this is what we're thinking, because they're going to have perspectives and thoughts that you may not capitalize on, that are going to help you avoid both cost surprises, but also a whole world of other surprises that can happen. So I think we've got to be more connected than we ever have been with one another.
Right. Wasn't DevOps supposed to do that for us?
Yeah.
That's the goal. And it's helped. It really has. I mean,
you mentioned FinOps.
We still got a lot more to do.
As another mechanism to bring, you know, the financial folks and the engineers together. And now we have folks that are maybe coming up for the first time in technology as cloud engineers. So they weren't previously network engineers due to their age and things like that. So yeah, it does seem like all of these things are converging to require us to be more proactive and more mindful about how we strategize, how we architect solutions, which, as you both have discussed at some length here in depth, it requires collaboration, and it really does require thinking about things differently. I mean, you mentioned in your previous employment, network team focused on-prem, your cloud team focused on the cloud. I assume at some point those two networks connected. So there has to be some collaboration. The more that happens, which is inevitable, especially with some repatriation of workloads now, when people are strategizing and saying, we're better off putting this in data center B over on the other side of town. That's just going to happen more and more. So, gentlemen, I really do appreciate your level of expertise, your insight, and your experience. And really just talking specifically about this area of cost in the cloud space. Really interesting stuff to me. And so I appreciate you both coming on and spending some time talking about it with me today. If anybody would like to reach out to you with a question or comment or concern, how can folks do that? TJ, we'll start with you.
Yeah, LinkedIn is probably the easiest bet, or you can get me at tj@crucial-clarity.com. I should say TJ is not just TJ. Sorry, I forget that sometimes. TEJAY at crucialclarity.com or just LinkedIn.
Perfect. And Carl, how about you?
Same thing. Just find me on LinkedIn. I'm always available.
Great. And you can still find me on Twitter, @network_Phil. Search my name, Philip Gervasi, on LinkedIn. And if you have an idea for an episode or would like to be a guest on Telemetry Now, I'd love to hear from you. Reach out to us at telemetrynow@kentech.com. So for now, thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.